From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. During the current term of the U.S. Congress, black lawmakers took a slew of positions of power. For example, James Clyburn of South Carolina was majority whip. There's one place where all the black congresspeople gather, that is the Congressional Black Caucus, or CBC. Until he resigned his office as senator, Barack Obama was a part of this powerful group. Now, with a new term of Congress looming, there's also a change of leadership at the CBC. The incoming caucus leader, announced just this week, is Congresswoman Barbara Lee of the 9th Congressional District in California. Congresswoman, welcome.
Good to be with you.
So you were just elected chairwoman of the Congressional Black Caucus. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Why did you want this position?
Well, I wanted to be chair of the Congressional Black Caucus for several reasons, but primarily, of course, our Congressional Black Caucus is an unbelievable institution within the House of Representatives that has consistently worked for change. Rightfully so, the Congressional Black Caucus is considered as the conscience of the Congress. And there are many, many tough issues and many challenges that are before us now, but this does provide a historic opportunity to come up with some very creative solutions. It's not going to be easy. We have many, many problems that the country is faced with, and we're going to have to just tackle them head on.
Are you willing to go up against the incoming president if you need to, if you disagree with his policies?
Well, first of all, let me just say President-elect Obama has run a magnificent campaign, and his agenda is an agenda that speaks to the aspirations of the American people. We're looking at how we have so much in common in terms of our overall agenda. And when you look at the economic downturn, the foreclosure crisis that's shattering the lives of millions of people, we're confident that once he's sworn in that we'll have some strong initiatives to really help the housing and foreclosure crisis. You know, Senator, President-elect Obama is a consensus builder. He's a unifier. And so I think that we're going to be unified on most of the issues.
You were the only person in Congress to vote against authorizing the use of force after the September 11th terrorist attacks. You thought it gave too much power to the president, that it was, in your words, a blank check. Now, President-elect Obama has long been a critic of the war, but he's set a certain timeline. Do you agree with his assessment that you could have a 16-month troop withdrawal? And how are you hoping to communicate with him about your feelings about the war?
As with all presidents, the Congressional Black Caucus, we've met with every president since I've been here, and that's for 10 years. And, of course, we intend to meet with President-elect Obama. But the president-elect was against the war in Iraq from day one. And he has said over and over again that he intends to end this in a very responsible way.
I want to know really what is your agenda, and by your, I mean the CBC, because a political contributor on our show this week, Ron Christie, said there's not a need for the CBC anymore. You've got a black man in the White House. Just wrap it up, folks. What do you say to that?
Well, let me first say we have many caucuses in the Congress. We have a Hispanic caucus, we have an Asian Pacific American caucus, we have a Congressional Black Caucus, we have a Congressional Progressive Caucus, which I served as co-chair for the last 4 years. We have the New Dems, we have the Blue Dogs. We have caucuses that represent the communities from which they come, but we come together as a unified body to work on the change that we all know must happen. And so I believe that we're going to maintain our caucuses and continue to work together because, you know, when you have strong caucuses, you have a stronger Democratic caucus. This is a democracy. We all have different ideas about how to accomplish our goals. But what's important is that, and we call this the Tri-Caucus, the Congressional Black Caucus, Hispanic Caucus, and the Asian Caucus, that we come together to look at the specific issues such as on health care reform. There are huge health disparities in communities of color in the United States. So we have to work together as a tri-caucus on a health care plan that recognizes those huge disparities as it relates to HIV and AIDS, diabetes, heart disease, asthma rates. And so there's a role and a very positive role for all of the caucuses in our Congress, including the Congressional Black Caucus.
All right. Congresswoman, great to talk to you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
That was U.S. Congresswoman Barbara Lee, the incoming chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. She represents California's 9th Congressional District. Now, that's big political news, the kind we hash over on our Reporters Roundtable. Joining us today, we've got Corey Dade, the Atlanta correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and Dominique DePrima, producer and host of the show The Front Page on KJLH in Los Angeles. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
So it's great to see you, Dominique, have you in the office. We don't work that far apart, you know, our offices, that is. So we talked a little bit about the CBC, and folks from the CBC, Congressional Black Caucus, were so scrappy during the Bush years and just really challenging the Bush agenda. But are people really ready, you think, to take on a black president?
Well, I mean, I think it's a double-edged sword. I think it's a real paradigm shift for most people who have been scrappy against the Bush agenda. What is my role now? Certainly, I would think Barbara Lee would push the envelope in terms of the peace agenda, as she has a strong record of doing so and has been well to the left of Senator Obama even on that question.
Corey, how do we measure as citizens or as journalists how, you know, organizations that have a traditional base in the black community, like the Congressional Black Caucus or the NAACP, are interacting with the president, and whether or not that they're holding the president who is incoming accountable?
Right. I actually wrote consistently about that throughout the campaign, and sort of Obama's relationship with traditional civil rights leaders, members of the Congressional Black Caucus. And we have to remember that many of the traditional African-American leaders, both in Congress and in the civil rights movement, were not Obama supporters. They came on late. They were pretty ardent critics of Obama through different periods. So the idea that they may, once he's elected, challenge him isn't surprising. I think the question will be how they react to what has been a clear sort of signal from the Obama campaign throughout in the past year, which is that they are trying to sort of de-racialize some of their policies, urban policies, policies that address crime, poverty, economic development. They want to, the Obama camp wants to shift the focus on many of those priorities to look at sort of the economic needs of different communities rather than sort of the traditional racially based needs, so that it may not be an NAACP or an urban league that gets sort of the ear of the president directly. It may be sort of a broader coalition of people from Latinos to African-Americans to just simply elected leaders who are able to get his ear and hopefully impossibly shape policy that way.
All right. I want to look at the local issues. Dominique, you're in California, and the governor has asked for some help. The budget here, not so great on the state level. I want to talk to Corey in a second about Atlanta. So there's states like California and cities like Atlanta asking, what can you guys do for us at this point? What do you think California's prospects are of getting some aid at this time where everybody's got their hand out?
Honestly, I just don't see how that's going to happen. I mean, we've got 50 states, and each one of them has a whole bunch of cities. Everybody's got their hand out, you know, and including, you know, they're competing with corporations. You know, I would love to see it happen. You know, we need the help here in California, but I don't see that happening. It reminds me of, you know, this we're too big to fail concept. California's too big to fail. But it's me, it's us. Well, sorry, everybody needs help right now, and I just don't see it happening.
Corey, we've had some really good conversations with Mayor Shirley Franklin of Atlanta, who was named, of course, one of the best mayors in the country. She seems very adamant that Atlanta should get a cut of what is, you know, people don't really know what it is becoming, but what was the financial bailout. Do you think that Atlanta or broadly cities have a shot at getting some of that money?
I don't think that's likely at this point. There's no indication that the Treasury Department and its sort of shifting priorities about how to use the money is going to do that. They are still focused on shoring up the financial industry in different ways. I think that, you know, for Mayor Franklin, Mayor Nutter and the rest, they campaigned very strongly for Obama. They were early Obama supporters, or at least Nutter became a supporter after supporting Clinton, Hillary Clinton, during the primaries. But this is their effort to stand up and be counted. And this is kind of a this is part and parcel of most urban mayors, big city mayors, coming out and demanding infrastructure funding and revitalization. And that's something they've been doing throughout the Bush administration to no avail. And I think what will happen is that you may not see funding come out of the $700 billion bailout package, but you may see funding and other policies going to cities through stimulus packages and others once Obama takes office, because mayors in particular have are poised to be a much stronger voice and have a much much greater influence on the administration through the U.S. Conference of Mayors in particular, because Obama has relied heavily on them to help shape his urban policies and to deliver votes. So I think that they will have a voice going forward, but not in this bailout.
Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, same thing. Clinton supporter, then jumped in with 2 feet, campaigned heavily for Obama. He's part of his economic advisory committee. And yet I agree, I just don't see us getting a check as much as we might need it.
All right, guys. Well, I want you to stay with us. We're going to come back to these issues of government, governance, money, all after a quick break. And just ahead, we also have how honest people are about their own racial hangups. Is the dialogue becoming more direct? We'll take a look as we continue an in-depth look at race in America. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We're back with our Reporters Roundtable. We've got Dominique DePrima, the producer and host of the show The Front Page on KJLH in Los Angeles, and Corey Dade, Atlanta correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Let's jump right back in. And I want to go back to Prop 8. This is just the issue that will not give it up. It is, in some ways, the hottest ongoing issue in California now that the presidential race has been decided. So it banned gay marriage in California. But this week, the state Supreme Court agreed to decide if the measure was legal. The court refused to let gay marriages resume until it considers the lawsuits. Now, they could hear the case as early as March. If the measure loses the court battle, is there any place else to go? Dominique?
I would say definitely yes. I mean, you know, the argument that people against Prop 8 have made, and I think convincingly, is that, you know, many of our civil rights or rights issues would have lost in a vote. So where do they end up? They end up in court, and they end up in the streets marching and demonstrating, and the LGBT community has shown a willingness to do that, and that's what's happening. Just one quick thing that I want to say is that I think the way this has been covered, as if African Americans are as a monolith against for Prop 8, is not fair, because it hasn't been broken out in terms of age groups, which I guarantee you would paint a different picture, party affiliation, income. We can go on and on. And so I think you have to look at that.
There's also this whole question of how black gays and lesbians have reacted. You had Wanda Sykes, a comedian, come out, not only just come out, but say, hey, I'm married. I went out and I got married, yeah. And me and my wife are really angry right now. Corey, there are a lot of black gay and lesbian groups getting ready to march here this coming weekend. Is there anything in Atlanta? Have you heard of any black gay and lesbian groups kind of gearing up to march? Or what has been the relationship between, you know, the black, I guess, for lack of better words, the black straight community, the black gay community, and the white gay community?
Well, there in Atlanta and most any other city, there has been a clear distinction between the black gay community and the white gay community. In Atlanta in particular, socially and sort of thematically, it is known not only, of course, as the black mecca for opportunity, jobs, et cetera, but it's a mecca for black gays. But when you talk about political activism, when you talk about sort of economic opportunities, advancement, the way gays kind of affect for the better a particular community, the white gay community here in Atlanta is much more established, much more higher earning, much more politically visible and active. It's not to say that black gays aren't, but it reflects this schism in the black community through age, through income, through religion, as was just said, but really, you know, the broader Black community still struggling with how they want to address homosexuality. And here, of course, we're in the Bible Belt. And so the other countervailing force is the strong churches that in some cases are fairly opposed to this. So I think you are seeing Black gays standing up and speaking out. I think this is a sort of singular opportunity for members of the Black community to do some internal work and really start looking inside themselves about where they want to be on this issue. Does it come down to a civil rights issue? Does it come down to simply addressing the homophobia in the Black community? This is, by the way, the state that voted to ban through a constitutional amendment that banned gay marriage a couple of years ago, and it rode largely on the backs of Black evangelicals who supported the ban itself. I will say one thing I think is interesting. To me, it's interesting that this is the first time that Republicans and conservatives overall have actually tapped Black antipathy or opposition to homosexuality for their own political purposes. And I think it's interesting that they did it here when in years past, and even in this election year with McCain, Republicans have steadfastly sort of written off or not campaigned for Black votes, but they did it here. It's quite interesting.
Just, Dominique, from your position as someone who is in the community, who is a journalist, who listens to people all the time, where do you think things are going to go from here in terms of a conversation about the intersection of civil rights, race, and sexual orientation? Do you think that there's going to be more openness over time?
I think so. I've seen it over the years, you know, over the past decade, I can see a change. I think that it should be noted that most Black progressives in California were busy electing a president. Prop 8 was not at the top of their agenda. And so I believe that if this same proposition were put to a vote in 2 months, when there wasn't such a crowded ballot, you would see a different result. And I think that this conversation is ongoing. I think it will continue to open up more. But I also think the results of this particular initiative in this particular state at this particular time are deceptive.
All right. I want to quickly hit one more issue, which is that this week a federal judge ruled that 5 Algerian men were held illegally at Guantanamo Bay prison camp. And he ordered the release of the detainees. They'd been there for almost 7 years. The same group of men won a Supreme Court ruling, said they had the right to seek release. Do you think that President Obama, and I'll start with you, Corey Dade, is going to face There are all signs that Eric Holder, the man he's tapped to be AG, and that the Obama administration will reassess Guantanamo, which already had faced, a severe rebuke from the Supreme Court, or rather, you know, the administration had for its policies towards this detainment center, this detention center. Do you think that the Obama administration will start getting the label that it could be too soft on terrorism, as we see some critics already trying to do?
Well, I think he will fight that that label, as it were, throughout, and especially as he figures out what timeline he's going to commit to redeployment of troops out of Iraq. So I think that will be something that he's going to persistently battle against. I think we need to remember that this was one of the executive orders that Obama has said that he will put forth when he takes office, which is to say shutting Guantanamo. So the issue may be moot after that point. I think it's interesting if he backs off of that or if he hesitates, then I think we in the media need to question kind of what's going on there. I think what's interesting, though, is the judge in this case that actually ordered the release of these 5 men is the same judge who was appointed by President Bush in 2005 and said these men had no habeas corpus rights. And it was, you know, perceived that he would be sympathetic to the government's case. So I think as far as political cover, no matter what sort of soft on terrorism criticism that President Obama may get, you know, internally, they can look at, you know, the fact that a Bush appointed federal judge actually gave them the political cover to close Guantanamo if they decide to.
Dominique, does this ever come up at all when you talk to people about issues that they care about? Or is this totally back burner given what's going on with the economy?
It does come up because people are concerned about the rights of people in the prison system here and internationally, how prisoners are treated. And are we seeing a deterioration of our rights under the Constitution of the United States? And I think even though you can say, well, these are enemy combatants or they're terrorists, at a certain point it comes down to people being detained and are we going to respect international laws? Are we going to respect our own Constitution? So I think, yes, it is a concern.
Dominique, it's been great to have you on. And Corey, great to have you back on.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with Corey Dade, Atlanta correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He joined us from Georgia Public Broadcasting. And Dominique DePrima, producer and host of the show The Front Page on KJLH in Los Angeles. She joined me here at NPR West. And let's step away from the headlines for a second and get real. We are all trying to make a way. Some of us have jobs with a bit of security. Others of us just got let go. And we have been asking people who have been laid off to contact us online. News and Notes, we really want to hear your story. People have already sent in some amazing stories. You can find out more about what we're looking for, which is just really some of you, some of your experiences, at nprnewsandviews.org. Some people say America is finally entering a post-racial age. That's an age when people of all races have the same equal opportunities. But some scientific studies show we might not be there yet. For example, researchers find some people automatically produce stress hormones when they see someone of a different race. So how do studies like these show how race perceptions manifest in our conscious and subconscious mind? This month, News and Notes is taking a look at race in America. We're asking, what is race and racism? When is it real and when is it imagined? We're going to take a little bit more of a sociological look today, and we're going to talk to Thomas J. Sugrue, a history and sociology professor at the University of Pennsylvania. His book is Sweet Land of Liberty, The Forgotten Struggle for Civil Rights in the North. And we've also got Richard Thompson Ford, professor at Stanford's Law School. He's the author of The Race Card, How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi, it's good to be here.
So, Thomas, you have done a lot to flesh out the subtleties of racism in the North. Give me an example of something you consider racism and define racism for me.
Racism is the inequitable distribution of power and resources in society. And a good example of that in the North would be racial segregation in housing and education, so that African Americans tend to live in communities with underfunded and understaffed schools. Whites tend to have access to better education and better resources because of the geographic divisions by race that are still pervasive in our metropolitan areas.
So, Richard, do you think racism still exists or that it's been overhyped or both?
Both, actually. Racism certainly still exists. We live in a society that's strikingly racially polarized, and I agree that some of the most severe racial problems involve racial segregation in our nation's cities and in our schools, where funding inequities and inequities in educational opportunity are a severe problem. And I could go on and talk about incarceration of particularly young black men in urban areas. So, no, we certainly have not overcome racism. At the same time, one of the things I say in my book is that we unfortunately tend to, when addressing racial problems, assume that there must be a racist behind them. And so we point the finger of blame at the person who happens to be on hand, when in many cases these problems are actually the effect of racism in the past, but not racists that are alive today. So I think we need to look to more comprehensive social solutions for these problems rather than trying to find a bigot to pin to the dartboard every time. But we absolutely still live in a society that's plagued by racism.
I would agree with Richard. I mean, ultimately, we spend too much time trying to finger individual racists and not look in the ways in which it's built into our everyday life, to our political institutions, to our neighborhoods. It's there where we live it that race still has real significance and meaning, not in terms of what we hold in our hearts or our souls.
Richard, when you talk about taking the focus away from individuals and putting them on systems, what are the means of redress and recourse? Because, for example, in some places, people have filed lawsuits. Every now and then you see a massive lawsuit on behalf of, say, employees at Coca-Cola or a certain company. Then, you know, you see everything from arbitration to conversation to, you know, petty rebellions. What's the recourse when you see racial systems go awry?
Well, the law provides for many mechanisms to deal with these types of problems. And the one thing I'd like to emphasize is that most people, both lawyers and non-lawyers, think that we have to find a racist in order to have legal redress. So the image that most people have in their minds is that we look for a discrete state of mind bigotry on the part of some decision maker in management, and once we find that, then we can have legal redress. But in fact, the law allows for redress even in circumstances in which there's no bigot to pin to the dartboard, but where we see policies and practices that have the effect of have a discriminatory effect on members of racial minority groups. And the remedies are, in some cases, for the employer to simply get rid of the policy if the policy isn't justified by a good economic reason or a good job related reason. In some cases, it involves monetary compensation to the class of injured individuals.
Thomas, when you have looked at racism or race in the North, which is what your book Sweet Land of Liberty looks at, how might people have played the race card differently in the North than they did in the South?
Well, I think a lot of Northern activists, and I think Southern activists did this as well, put attention on trying to ascertain individual intentions rather than looking at the ways in which race and racial inequality were built into the structure of the economy. That it wasn't just a matter of racist employers individually harboring negative thoughts about African Americans. That was part of the story. But a really important part of the story was the ways in which the cumulative effect of those decisions over time set up workplaces in ways that basically cordoned off African Americans to one type of job and gave whites opportunities for other types of jobs. And that goes beyond an emphasis on individual intention to really looking at the whole way we organize our workplaces, our neighborhoods, our everyday life.
Richard, just briefly, how have people who were not black and not white, Latinos, Asian Americans, Native Americans, people of mixed race, been treated in this kind of dialogue?
Well, the law prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, regardless of one's race. So it treats Latinos, Asians, Native Americans, to the extent they're understood as racial groups, exactly in the same way that it would treat African Americans. And indeed, it also prohibits discrimination against whites. So legally, there's no distinction made between the various racial groups. Now, of course, in social dialogue, I think it's fair to say that most of our country's discussion about race relations has taken the form of a kind of a black-white paradigm, that was the most striking, those were the most striking examples historically of racial discrimination, and even today, they define many of the most severe cases. But I think that dialogue is beginning to shift, particularly as Latinos become such a large proportion of the minority communities in the United States.
All right, gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We were speaking with Richard Thompson Ford, professor at Stanford University's Law School. His book is called The Race Card, How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. Also, speaking with Thomas Segrue, professor of history and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. He is the author of Sweet Land of Liberty, The Forgotten Struggle for Civil Rights in the North. Richard Thompson Ford spoke to us from KQED in San Francisco. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Will Smith promotes a new film without describing it, and black comedian Wanda Sykes comes out and announces she's married to a woman at a Prop 8 rally. Will other black stars follow suit? Here to get us up to speed in the latest in entertainment news, we've got Allison Samuels, a national correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Hi, Allison.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing great. So, you know, there's all the big holiday films starting to come out. I occasionally will read Variety, and there's all these pictures and for your considerations and something on billboards right now, all around Los Angeles at least, is Will Smith.
Right.
He's on the billboard for something called 7 Pounds. It's a very simple just sort of image of his face. It's due out next month. We don't know much except there's a twist ending. So what have you heard about it?
It's funny. I saw the film. I saw the film a couple of days ago. And at the screening, they tell you not to tell anybody what the film is about afterwards. But, you know, it's very it's a different Will than you're used to seeing. I mean, Pursuit of Happiness was somewhat in the same vein, but Pursuit of Happiness had a really great ending and a happy ending. And this movie is definitely much more thought-provoking, much more just a reality check on just sort of basically making one mistake and how that impacts the rest of your life and so many other people's lives the whole time. And it is so clear that I think Will is obviously, you know, trying to up his game in terms of the seriousness of his roles, and also, you know, just making sure the Oscar people recognize that, you know what, he can go from one extreme to the other without, you know, any sort of hesitation. In this movie, he's just so intense, and it's a very haunting role for him. You know, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see who actually goes to see it because it's not exactly the most uplifting movie for Christmas. But it is very much a people movie in terms of what life is really about. If you're questioning that, this is the movie for you.
Intriguing. All right. On a much more, you know, he's been someone who has been able to transition into these big action roles.
Right.
And the comic book Godfather Stan Lee floated the idea that Will Smith could be Captain America.
Right.
He said back in September, this is Stan Lee, if Barack Obama becomes president, who knows? Suddenly a lot of our characters will be black. And he really mentioned that Will Smith could be someone who could take on that kind of role. We've already seen a lot of black folks with superpowers in some of the newer TV efforts like Heroes.
Right.
But do you think some of these classic heroes could be reborn as black people?
I certainly think so. And I think Will Smith can do it no matter what. I think he probably could have been, you know, he could have done it probably before Barack Obama was, you know, made president, because I think he has that universal mainstream appeal that people sort of just are drawn into anything that he does and anything that he, you know, just sort of puts out there. And also he just has that sort of every guy sort of, you know, sort of personality. And he's played superheroes before as well. So I think that would work really, you know, that would probably be a box office hit for him. And I think, you know, like I said, I think he is at the point where he's trying to go back and forth, like do this really serious movie one moment and then go and do something lighthearted and fun the other. So I think, you know, he's at the top of his game at this point. You know, at 40 years old, he's really at the top of his game.
He just doesn't even have enough time to spend all that money.
I'm
so
saying.
You know. All right, let's move on to something that's a little bit more in the serious political realm. Proposition 8, we've been talking about it constantly on this show because it has, to a certain extent, divided the black community and the gay community and brought up a lot of questions about social values and how you construct your place in a pluralistic society.
Right.
Well, of course, there are people who are not just black or gay, but both.
Yes.
One of them is Wanda Sykes. Now, she actually came out and, you know, let's just listen to a little bit about her.
Okay.
It's very simple. If you don't believe in same-sex marriage, then don't marry somebody of the same sex.
That is actually before she came out. And so here's what she had to say then.
When my wife and I leave California, I want to have my marriage also recognized in Nevada, in Arizona, all the way to New York. But I am very proud. I am proud to be a woman. I'm proud to be a black woman. I'm proud to be gay. And I love you all. Now let's go get our damn equal rights. Come on.
How do you think that played out? You know, I'm gonna ask you how this played on a few different levels. First off, career-wise, do you think it's good or bad for her career-wise?
Well, I think being a comedian and also being someone who does a lot of writing behind the scenes, I think she'll be okay. And she's also, you know, she's not the huge megastar that I think some of the other people who might be a little bit more concerned about their... Wanda's not doing family movies. That's just not who she is. So I think Wanda will be okay. What's unfortunate to me is that it couldn't have happened a little sooner. I mean, well, maybe actually a little earlier in this game, because I think that would have made a big difference in terms of going out and talking to African-American communities, because I think that is the problem, is that there are no visible faces out there that come to the churches and come to the black communities to sort of talk about what this means to me personally. How does this impact me and you? And I think, you know, it's helpful then, but it probably would have made a huge impact if she had done it a little bit earlier.
That's what I was going to ask, yeah. As the second part, is how much do you think it affected the community? But on the third level, there are, you know, and I always try to be delicate about this because we're dealing with other people's reporting. Mm-hmm. There's a movement, an entertainment site, MediaTakeout.com, is reporting via an unnamed source that Queen Latifah is getting pressured by gay advocacy groups to come out publicly, mm-hmm. that they want her to speak at the People's Choice Awards in January. She has been printed up in the tabloids for having a relationship with her personal trainer, but, you know, only she can say whether or not they're in a relationship. Mm-hmm. Do you think people have to say?
Oh, no, I don't think people have to say. And I think, you know, that's an example of someone who I think has a lot more to lose by coming out and talking about whatever her relationship is with the trainer or whomever. And in the New York Times, she sort of made this clear. She didn't care about what people think in terms of what her relationships are, what if she's gay or if she's not gay. That's something that she doesn't have to answer. And I agree, you know, she doesn't have to answer that. Would it be helpful? Yes. If in fact she is gay, if she came out and talked about it, yes, it would be helpful. But that's her personal decision. And I don't think anybody can force her to sort of do that, particularly when they don't know what the ramifications would be to her long term. You know, that's something only she would know and be able to sort of, you know, gauge. And that's why I'm saying, when you compare her to Wanda Sykes, she has so much more to lose because she does do family films. You know, she is the one who's on the cover of women's magazines and in love stories and all that kind of stuff. I just don't know if it benefits her to do that. You know, it would have to be a personal decision where she felt like, this is important to me. I want to make this, you know, stand.
All right, Allison, thank you.
You.
That was Allison Samuels, a national correspondent for Newsweek magazine, and she joined us here in the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. Now we've got some holiday cheer, soulful cheer. For many of us, there's nothing that puts you in the spirit like Christmas music. You've got the classics from Nat King Cole and Bing Crosby, the comedy of the Chipmunks, and even hip-hop Christmas raps. But you have never had Aretha Franklin until now. The new album, This Christmas Aretha, features classic and contemporary songs infused with Miss Franklin's trademark R&B, soul, and gospel styles. I got a chance to talk to the Queen of Soul about one of her favorite passions, that's cooking, and her new foray into holiday music.
Christmas is so special for so many reasons. Each time it comes around, you hear very, very little on me. I'm not in the mix. And it's such a special time, as I said. But, you know, get the picture. The snow is softly falling. You've got a nice warm fire going. Maybe you're holding hands with your sweetie next to the fire, or maybe you got a lot of good pots on the stove in the kitchen, and all of that, you know, the good smells are wafting through the house, and the bells ringing, people are gift giving, and the music is going, and there's nothing on Aretha. Please, I gotta record some Christmas music.
So what's your favorite song on this? I mean,
favorite song, the whole album is my favorite. But my really, really, really favorite one is The Lord Will Make a Way and Angels We Have Heard on High.
Yeah. Couple other things. You were named number one vocalist of the rock era by Rolling Stone magazine.
I heard that.
How does that make you feel?
Oh, please. If I'm not careful, I might not be able to get out the doorway. My head might get caught in the doorway. It's a tremendous honor. It really is. And I am most appreciative for it.
It sounds like you don't, but do you ever get blasé about all the things that you've done and all the times people tell you that they love your work and that kind of appreciation, either from critics or from fans?
Oh, absolutely not. It's that's a good thing, and I'm delighted to hear it all the time. It's when you don't hear it, there's a problem. So I'm delighted to hear it all the time. It's a continuing acknowledgement of my work, and that means an awful lot to me.
I admit that I'm a huge holiday fan, and I come from a family with a lot of serious traditions and also people who are serious cooks.
Yes,
and you
so am I.
Are a serious cook, and on this album, you have this whole conversation about your holiday cooking, and you talk about how the chitlins almost killed you, so you weren't making them again. Now, do you mean health-wise you're not going to make chitlins anymore?
No, chitlins are out, and they are off the menu, and anything like chitlins for me. A, they were keeping my weight up, and B, they run your pressure up and things like that. So chitlins have been canceled off of my list, and I know my fans and friends are screaming hallelujah.
Well, you know, folks want you around for a long time. And
I want to be around for a long time, Farai. So let's drop the chitlins.
Since we know what's off the list, the chitlins are off the list, you have to give us a list of two or three things you think you're going to make as a cook over the holiday season.
Okay. Two or three things I'm going to make: baked chicken and dressing for sure. I'm going to do mixed greens, turnips and mustards. I'm going to do an ambrosia the way my grandmother used to make it. And let's see, mac and cheese for sure. And you said just a few things.
That's well, hey, this thing. I'm loving this.
Okay, that just sounds like Mickey D's. I'm loving it.
Well, look, the Queen of Soul thing could also apply to the Queen of Soul food thing, because when you told us last time that you had made oxtails while you were cooking on your bus, I was like, now that is a woman who has some dedication to cooking. Let me just ask, how do you make your greens? What do you put meat or no meat? And
actually, this time I'm going to use some smoked turkey. I hear that that is really, really wonderful. But after cleaning them, because, you know, greens are so gritty and so dirty, you have to clean them first, of course, before you put them on. One of the ladies from the church who took care of us when we were children taught me a long time ago, she said, just put a little bit of a teaspoon, maybe like a half a teaspoon of maybe soap powder in your greens, like something like Cheer. Or
Tide. You're kidding me.
I'm not kidding you. That's how dirty they are.
So just when you're rinsing them, I was like, you cannot put that in the pot.
When you're cooking them in the sink, just put that in there with it. And then, you know, you're working with it with your hands and everything and working that grit out of those greens. Listen, you won't believe how much dirt and grit comes out of those greens.
Okay,
and
so
all of that. And you rinse them so many times until they're just sparkling and can't be cleaner. And then I just, of course, put them on top of the ham hocks with some crushed red peppers and a little bit of garlic powder. I like that.
I think about the areas that you and I are from, Michigan and Maryland, and in some ways, right now we're going through these incredibly tough economic times, and it's not going to be a very comfortable holiday for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. So, that's absolutely right.
I know that you do a lot of philanthropic work. How does the work that you do that we might not know so much about intersect with people's lives who are trying to just make a way out of no way?
I donate heavily to the church and various churches in the Detroit community and food banks. So that's just some of what I do.
Now, we've talked about food and health, but you may also be saving people's lives, because there's this new study out that says that listening to music produces endorphins that then lower your blood pressure.
Like laughter, right?
Exactly.
I can believe that. I absolutely believe that. depends on what you're listening to. It's calming, it's soothing. You know, they say music soothes the savage beast, right?
Absolutely.
But music can do a lot of things. It transcends a lot of barriers.
What are you looking forward to?
Well, I think I'm going to be at the House of Blues for a very special performance for them, November 21 and 22 in Los Angeles.
Hmm.
And I am waiting for a rewrite on the script for my autobiography and just getting ready for the holidays.
Well, Aretha Franklin, it is always great to talk to you and have our wide-ranging conversations. So if I don't personally get to see you over the holiday season, I wish the best to you and yours.
Okay, Varai, thank you.
Hang on a mistletoe, I'm gonna get
That was the Queen of Soul, Miss Aretha Franklin, talking about her new holiday CD, This Christmas Aretha. That's News and Notes. Nicole Childers and Christabel Nsiabwati produce the show. Sasha Woodruff edits and Devin Robbins is our director. Our technical director is Shireen Strausberg. Marcia Caldwell and Don Spalding are our drive engineers. Our staff includes Tony Cox, Roy Hurst, Jeffrey Bennett, Jeffrey Gardner, Zachary Slobig, and Sonata Lee Narcisse. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Hairdressers as therapists? Some groups say beauty salons can be refuges for abused women. So how can beauty professionals help women get out of the cycle of violence? We'll find out Monday. I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.